So tonight's talk is called Loving Freedom. Or you could have a subtitle called Freedom is Loving. I'd like to start by deconstructing last night's talk a little bit. Because last night's talk, at least in part, focused on what works for you. And maybe you already thought about this, and maybe you didn't. But who's the you that the practice is going to work for? Is the you that the practice is going to work for the one who's got what he, she wants and is trying to get to it? The he or she that has habits that at times take over? Is the you that the practice is going to work for or the teachings are going to work for the one who has the goal of life clarified? Or is the one that the practice and the teachings need to work for the real you? And is there, or what is, the difference between, I don't like the word too much, but I'll use it, the false you and the real you? And how do you know? Okay, so tonight's talk is about a different subject than that. One of the things about these talks sometimes is, you know, one can walk oneself into a corner. You kind of paint yourself into a corner, and then you have to figure out how to get out of it. Or you just say, well, we'll do something else. I would like to tie that back. You've been listening to, at least to some extent, what your mind might say are just flat-out pure contradictions coming out of this mouth over here. Things like, there is no you. Or maybe the real you is no you. Didn't say that yet, but might as well have. There is no self. Except there's an idea that there's a self. And then this awareness thing. Awareness is, but no one can find it. And then one we started with on Wednesday night, probably not too contradictory at this point. The mind has no pride. It'll do anything. Have you at least been a little entertained by what your mind has been doing? Because if you're not entertained with it, how do you think anybody else is going to be if you try to talk about it? I have I'll go ahead and admit it, a habit of trying to avoid the food line. And I haven't talked at all about the food line or the food much on this residential, so just a few comments. I made the decision when the bell rang after the yoga and the 15-minute sit there before dinner to make an effort to be first in line. And I lost quickly. In fact, I didn't even get on the winner's stand. You know how it's 1, 2, 3, and number 4. Occasionally they stick number 4 in just over on the side. You know, they're kind of like down on the edge of the photograph. A lot of times they're not even in there. It's just 1, 2, 3, okay? So I'm in there and I'm number 4. Now, some of you can relate to this one, and some of you might not. But if you do more of this stuff, you will definitely be able to relate to this one. When you're in the food line ahead of people, and the line starts piling up behind you, okay, one, two, three, four, and on some of these events that I've done, it's like 50 people back there, okay, and it's your turn to get the salad, and the prongs aren't exactly working right, and you feel these eyes, they may not be there, but you just feel these eyes upon you. And then you struggle and you either put too much on or you put too little on, and you're a little caught there and you go back, maybe, and you say, let me out of here. Try to move on. So thus, I developed a method, which was to try to avoid that. Basically, go as late as possible. And then sometimes, the food would be gone. Or at least the thing that looked the best. Whatever was left there. I can go on and on. Anyways, when I had the privilege, and it really was a privilege, some 20 or so years ago, more like 25 now, actually, my mind is a little forgetful, to do this practice with my partner, my wife, mother of our children, and a demonstration of how the mind has no pride goes like this. I was in line ahead of her for food, and can't remember what I was getting, but I was putting the food on there, and putting on what to me was the right amount, and she happened to have a chance to be watching me do this, and her mind commented, and she told me later about this, and I didn't ask for this, okay? But she commented later to me. She said, "Do you want to hear what my mind did when I saw you in the food line? What a pig." Because there was a perception that I was piling it on. What a pig. Years later, when she'd abandoned me in the meditation and gone on a different way, she doesn't formally meditate, hasn't in years, in the way that we're sitting around doing it. And whenever things go awry, she usually comments that I need to meditate more. That cushion stuff is really working for you, huh? How's your breath, Paul? So, it just keeps happening. The process just keeps unfolding. So I was in the food line once out at a retreat in California, and I was just having a wonderful retreat out in the desert, and all these great teachings, and the weather, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, community. Try to get to this, too. Someone asked about why the sangha is important. Meditation was going wonderful, to me at least, because I was feeling really good. And to me in those days, if I was feeling really good, the meditation's going. I'm cooking here. And then the bliss hit. I haven't talked about bliss much, but the bliss hit. In this case, the bliss was coming straight down through the top of the head. It was like, boom. And it was time to get food. Okay, so it wasn't vertigo, but it was something akin to vertigo. If, I was going to exaggerate, it was kind of going like this inside. And I, needed to eat, because this was fine, but I also needed to eat. So I got in the food line, and I got my spaghetti on my plate, and my spaghetti was going like this. And the next thing you know, my spaghetti went right off the side and on the floor. And the bliss turned into absolute, utter embarrassment. And you know why there's only one? You know why non-duality is the reality? Because bliss and total embarrassment are the same in one key way. The face is full of blood. If you need a little bit more reinforcement on the grace of dropping your plate in the food line, this guy's got a story over here that will knock mine right out of the ballpark. Just hit him up on it. And if you need to come in, Steve, don't hesitate. If you want or need to come in on this one. And see, because I could tell a story, but it wouldn't be as good if you tell the story, you see. Because it would be your story to tell, not mine. Mind, the thinking mind has no pride. Let's come at it from a different angle. I've suggested that there is the screen, the movie on the screen, and the one you could say watching the movie, missing the screen. I've suggested that life is unfolding out here, the experiences, all of the stuff, and that awareness, in a way, is back here watching. But let's actually go to the movies. Now, all of us have been to the movie, or movies. Some of us might at times have even thought of ourselves, and even to this day, perhaps, I'm a movie buff. I love movies. I read about movies, I talk about movies, I suggest others go to movies. But one way or another, how you get to the movie is not so important as that when you go in, you have probably thought to yourself or said to someone else, I'm going to the movies. You sit down, the movie, oh, sorry. There's enough of those, what do you call them, pre-movie movies, that you're like, another one, another one, another one. You know, and the people who are experienced in that world, they just sit back. You never see them looking at their watch because they're like, great, more, more, more. More of those pre-movie movies. What are they called?
Previews.
Previews, thank you. And then finally the movie starts and you're already exhausted. Because the so-called good movie makes you sad, makes you happy, makes you excited. It works hard to frighten you. It might calm you down. That's more rare. It can depress you. Maybe exhilaration. It's probably going to play out a theme of good and evil. Classic, right? And if you're lucky, just like on this residential, you get an insight. Wow. And it wasn't like insightful, like, wow, that director was really insightful. Wow, that script was really insightful. Wow, that was insightful, the way they put the music. That's easy to say that's insightful. No, you had an insight about your life. But all of it is and was a movie. Imagine that everything that has been going through this mind since we sat down Wednesday night, or sorry, Wednesday morning, is simply a movie. Not to diminish it, not to negate it, not to judge it. How about just call it what it is? Sometimes we might say, I feel besieged by life. Oh, I forgot to mention besiegement. Besiegement in the movie. Someone's besieged. Someone's besieging someone else. Nature's besieging someone. Someone's besieging nature. It's really sad sometimes, but humans are besieging animals. An animal besieges a human. Besieged by life. Isn't it really besieged by your mind? And then that mind projects out and says, life's besieging me. I suggested last night that the teachings remind us, and if we feel like we've never known it before, the teachings tell us for the first time, you must take full responsibility for this precious existence. And then they go another step and they tell you how to do it. Have you noticed in the common discourse in our culture how much time, money, words, and books are spent describing the problems? Mm-hmm. And a lot less about the real solutions. You get a good book, it lays it out, wow, that's new, that's different, and you get like one paragraph at the end. And it might even fall a little short because it's like, that's it? Will that work? I was at a conference once, years ago, it was like 300 people in the keynote address for psychology, probably more like 500 in the room. We're in a big ballroom. And the keynote, because there's keynotes, and then there's the keynote, right? The big keynote, the big kahuna keynote. So this dude gets up there, and he's giving a great talk, and it's funny and everything. Well, sort of funny. You know, it was really serious at times, too. And he's laying this all out. And he really comes up to, as if he's going to take us to the solution. Everybody's kind of bated breath, and then he just tells another joke. And that's it. It was a good joke, I can't remember it, but it was a good joke, and I wrote it down for a while, and I told it a couple of times myself, and then I lost the note, so I can't tell you. I was like, The Bhagavad Gita is a great, what is it? Spiritual text. It's not a novel, certainly not a movie. Call it a legend in a written form. Let me call it a spiritual text. The Bhagavad Gita says this: no effort is lost and no obstacle exists. Even a little of this Dharma delivers from great fear. Meditation is about how these filters, and they are filters, between what is directly occurring, directly being experienced, and what we would prefer to be experiencing, the filters between those begin to soften. And even as they're softening, we can still be blinded, blindly walking, blindly sitting, blindly breathing, blinded by seeking. The need to search for meaning, for purpose, a belief in direction, in time, and outcome can at times feel tenacious. The seeker never finds what is being sought. The seeker actually has no idea what it's seeking. And yet every time this seeking softens or drops, relief appears. We're exploring the possibility of transcending the limitation that suggests we must be different. We must be different in order to be free. We must change somehow. And it's so clear that there is no agreed upon answer amongst us humans as to what life is. Because life is as it is. life itself as it is the living answer to the question, what is life? Neuroscience is rolling in the research into the brain. And one of the recent ones is the discovery that there is no central governing structure in there, which is their way of coming to the realization that there's no I or self. But us brainy ones are going to continue to lament, hang on, argue, and debate the words and what they mean. Freedom, emancipation, here's another possible contradiction. Freedom, emancipation is not the result of anything. Freedom, emancipation is not the result of anything. Freedom is not the opposite of the view or idea that you are not free. Freedom is what appears when the seeking of freedom falls away. And it's always a surprise party. Not what you projected or thought or imagined it would be. This brain mind has a big habit called trying to define things and hold them in perspective. That's why, even though I wouldn't recommend dropping your plate in the food line, if it happens, your perspective will be disturbed. The good news is, in these kind of situations, very rarely do you get scolded or asked to leave. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to get kicked out of the Dharma. How did school go? Well, I got kicked out of Dharma class. You see, where it's very, very subtle and very tricky is this process of meditation, and it is a process of meditation. Meditative living. Let's go there. Meditative living. It does not result in liberation. Liberation isn't the result of anything. Living meditatively, let's say what it is. I just said what it isn't. Living meditatively simply assists in releasing the distortions of perception that prevent us from realizing the truth of freedom definitively. You can see this for yourself. You can be sitting there, and even if just a little tiny insight pops through, the mind likes to think, oh, sitting still did this, following the breath did this, getting this much concentration did this, not being distracted did this. And you don't know that. That's a guess. That's a guess. Just like science doesn't even know what starts the fetus's heart in the womb. It starts. They haven't nailed that down yet. Or at least the science that I'm up on. Maybe they got it and I missed it. In a very real sense, all this is about is seeing through the conditioned perceptual distortions that suggest freedom is not what we already are. And when these veils, which in Hinduism is called Maya, when these veils are seen through, then what remains is the light of freedom. a little tricky for the brain mind to get that the meditation isn't making that happen. So let's use an imagination now. Imagine a black bull and a white bull together, or joined together by a yoke around their necks. Notice if the black bull is on the left or on the right in your mind. And both positions are correct. Is the black bull the fetter for the white bull? Or is the white bull the fetter for the black? No matter which bull might pull harder or longer, of course, it's clear that neither is the fetter for the other. It is the yoke around their necks that is the fetter that binds them together. In this same way, it's not the sense organs which are given as part of the nature of the body-mind. It's not the sense organs or the sense experiences, that is the objects, all these are different experiences that have been happening, that fetter us. It's the grasping, resisting, and delusion that arises in between the sense organ, and the sense experience. That's where all the problems for the human takes place, right in there. Right in there between the sense organ and the sense experience. Sense contacts are just unfolding freely. I've been pointing at them, hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, body touching, thinking. And yet when the mind grasps or resists what's arising at the sense doors, there's the yoke, there's the fetter. So, as the sense contacts are just unfolding freely, and when the mind resists, we can sense for sure how stress is born, right there. As the sense contact is occurring, naturally unfolding, and the mind grasps, we can sense how stress is born right there. We can feel it. And as it becomes just a little bit more clear that nothing is possessible and nothing can be sustained, all of this is coming and going. But yet when delusion arises as the yoke in between the sense organ and object, whatever that object is, we can see the mind trying to possess what's happening. Make it stable. And say, this is me, or this is mine. In a way, what I'm pointing at now is that this meditation, exploration, this inquiry, at least in part, is not so much about seeing who you really are. It's seeing who you're not, and yet have taken yourself to be. If you take yourself to be that grasping and that resistance, there's your suffering. If you see that that's not you, there's your freedom. as an opening, and this is what we've been experiencing together, as this opening happens in the body and the feelings and the mental flow, we can begin to see how this identifying tendency tends to center most strongly around the sense of being conscious. I am being conscious. I am the one being conscious. It's very powerful, agreed upon, entrenched idea in the mind. I am conscious. And not only that, but we find ourselves working hard sometimes at staying conscious and keeping our perception and our sense of the world organized. So some of you may remember this one. A movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Wonderful scene. Can get the Dharma even at the movie theater. Richard Dreyfuss is sitting at the dinner table with the family all around, with his hands piling together the mashed potatoes, saying, "This matters." And they're all looking at him like he's crazy. If you haven't seen it, it's worth it for that scene alone. Dharma's not supposed to sell anything, but when it comes to mashed potatoes and Richard Dreyfuss, it's okay. The profound and simple truth is that awareness is freely occurring with or without the idea that you're aware. Just like the body's freely breathing, whether you're aware of it or not. Isn't that interesting? It's being taken care of just fine. Body functions, doing just fine. Whether the mind body's sleeping, walking around, sitting, so much of this is just taking care of itself. It doesn't need to be organized by your consciousness and held together and reorganized and reorganized and reorganized. In fact, the more, you could say, relaxed this thing becomes, the better it tends to function. The less it's stressed out, the better it tends to function. And yet I go around thinking I need to hold this together. I need to maintain this. Everything is naturally organized, naturally unfolding. Everything in the universe exists as a form and formless energy, and as such is in a constant state of flux. And this includes, of course, mental intention or volition. Now let's go there. Mental intention or volition as the subtle form of the same life energy, inseparable, that manifests when it's recognized as the about-to moment before the body moves in sitting, the about-to moment before the hand moves to pick up the fork, the about-to moment before the mouth opens and the words come out. And when this energy, this volitional energy, this mental intention is identified with as me, humans then believe that they have choice, and they go further than that and they believe they are the chooser. It gets even more neurotic at times when they start believing they are the chosen. And then there's somebody who's not chosen. Out of it, lost your way. You better come home. We're the chosen. Absolute neurosis. Actually, it's close to psychosis. Do you know the difference between neurosis and psychosis? The neurotic person or the neurotic mind, excuse me, has a sense at least some of the time that they're neurotic. The psychotic person does not, most of the time. In fact, they go further in thinking that other people are psychotic and they're not. Yeah. I'm fine. And you know what? This is really spooky. Maybe they are right. I'm going to get out of that corner right now. So, the idea that you're the chooser, that you have choice and have free will, comes powerfully into question, and necessarily so in this awakening, as the direct experience of what is actually occurring begins to register more and more fully, especially as we're sitting, and it becomes clear that this and this and this and this and this and this and this, and do I need to say this again? And this is happening, and no one's choosing it. It's just happening. But then real quickly, the bell rings. Well, not so quickly for some of us. Ring that damn bell, Paul. Ring it now. You have no idea what I'm thinking about. If you did, you would feel great fear. One of my teachers used to sit, right? He was like a golden orb. He was like, not a human, he was like an orb. He had no neck. His head was like a big giant pumpkin. And he sat there, and his lips were really big. And he would sit there, and then as the meditation went on, I'd see his head go down a little bit. You weren't supposed to look in those days, but I would always cheat because I'm a little mischievous. So this head would go down like this, and it just intense. We never did walking in those days. It was just sit, 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 sit. His head would go down like this, and I swore he was asleep. Right down here, right around somewhere in here, I was totally convinced. He's out of it. He doesn't care about us. He's killing us here on the cushions. He's psychotic. And then, then the sitting would end. Ah, wonderful relief. Out of that prison of my mind. This idea that you're the chooser, this idea that you have free will, and take it apart a little bit later. But for now, it's just another expression of life energy. It's just really the energy of intention and the idea that you are that. I moved my arm. I spoke these words. I can choose to not listen to you. On and on and on it goes. If energy is not created nor destroyed and simply changes in form, just like water turns into ice or steam depending on the temperature, everything is constantly becoming something other than it was the moment before. Now here's where it gets real interesting, potentially. The desire to realize freedom is quite different than any other desire, in that not only in most cases, not all, but most cases, is it necessary for awakening and liberation, but even more compelling is that it actually cannot bring the realization of freedom. Interesting, huh? It's necessary, but not sufficient. It is the falling away of this most profound form of desire, what some people call the great desire. It is the falling away of this desire that allows true seeing true insight, true realization, true freedom. It turns out that desire is the yoke. It binds human beings to perpetual wandering. And if you don't have a sense that you're wandering, even as the sitting on the cushion's taking place and the body's not moving, then you're either asleep, you're free, or you haven't seen the nature of the conditioned mind. It is desire that drives the seeking for home, and it is desire that suggests freedom is somewhere other than where we currently are. It is desire that drives the search for meaning and purpose, and it's desire that in fact gives rise to the birth of these bodies. It is desire that makes and combines with delusion, making humans think madly, I would add, that all they have to do is get clear enough about what they want and then want it enough, and this will bring it about by the law of attraction or some other universal principle. Got to get that universal principle in there somehow, keep it interesting and big so that we really do have a sense that we're connected to something greater than ourselves, even as we're busy trying to have it our way. If having it my way and desire could bring about liberation, if just desiring it could bring about liberation, what are we doing sitting around on our butts? Just want it clear enough, bang, it's done. This is clearly not the case, because not only does the mind have no idea how to directly even imagine liberation, has no idea what it is, except the absence of what it doesn't want. Little does it know that it actually blindly doesn't want itself. It's in its own way, thinking something else is in the way, and that's freedom. We can also see that happiness arises when desire falls away, not when desire appears to bring its object home. It's very important. The cessation, the temporary happiness we get when we get things our way, is not because we got things our way, it's because desire fell away. And if you then want to start working on, let me see how to have no desire, good luck. Good luck. Start now. And keep it going. There are three specific yokes or fetters. I'd call them interesting predicaments. Or you could call them perceptual distortions that need to be seen through. The first is the personality view, the second is the doubt in the teachings, and the third is the belief that rites and rituals will bring deliverance. Which one shall we do first? I wanted to do the personality view first, but maybe we should do that last. You want to do that first? Mm-hmm. Doesn't take long. Do you have a personality view or not? Yes, you have a problem. No, we're done. Delusion arising out of the ignoring tendency. The whole blindness occurs because of the ignoring tendency, not seeing what's really going on. Ignorance doesn't mean you're stupid, although some of us are. It means the ignoring of what's really going on. That's what ignorance is. So the delusion that arises once ignorance is mobilized suggests, spellblinds us into thinking there's an individual in here. Now watch this. Bodies sitting in a room, right? No disagreement on that one. Where are the individuals? You can look around.
In case there was one.
Say, well, oh, what about the personality? I mean, there's these different personalities, right? These personalities. You know what that is? It's the collection of the five aggregates, body, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, combined in a nice little, you know, sort of unique pattern, same ingredients. And that makes for the differences. That's what's sitting here. Body, feelings, perception, mental activity, consciousness. That's it. But what's really fun, I think, is that there is one Dharma. There can only be one Dharma. And yet that one Dharma expresses itself in different ways all the time. I remember a point where I had a real, real big sort of ongoing existential, you might say, dilemma, crisis, depression. It was unrelenting. I was married and clearly heading towards children, led by my wife. And I mean that. I was led to the altar and to the guillotine. And I mean that only in the sense the guillotine on what you think life's about. I'm going to not go further there because some of you are laughing and some of you aren't. So. These risky little corners, you know, around the corners of blind alley. Oh. And I was very deeply in the meditation, and I really thought I'd made a deep mistake, that I should be in a monastery, not married. And so I was complaining about this mostly in my own head and sometimes out loud to anyone who would listen. It was a very compelling movie. And I was playing all the parts. And I was with a Dharma friend and had finished a retreat and was in his house, and the television was on, and his two twin boys were sitting watching the television. They were twins. They were about, you know, yay high. And they both had their headsets on. So you just to picture this, these two little guys, they were twins, sitting there on the couch, you know, feet not touching, so the couch is up, feet not touching, and they're sitting there side by side, shoulders touching, with their headsets on. And stupid me, okay, because stupidity manifests, you know, spontaneously as part of the expression of freedom and the Dharma, I say, why the headsets? And he looks at me like I'm really stupid. And he says, so I don't have to listen to the TV. Okay. Then I moved on to a more important issue, which was my dilemma, my existential dilemma about, am I going in the right direction? You see, because when you believe there's a direction that you should be going in, then inevitably you're going to encounter moments where you're not sure whether you're right or not. Guaranteed. Is this the right way? It really gets risky when you start asking other people. Is this the right way? And then they go, You know, somebody says this and somebody says this. And then what? So I was coming out with it a bit, and I was thinking, you know, it's just really like, I really feel this incompatibility between, you know, the meditation and the Dharma, you know, and what I feel, you know, I should be doing. You know, I really want to go to Thailand. You know, I really want to go to Thailand and to Burma and meditate. And you know, I'm looking at his kids, and they're just so sweet looking, and the headsets were just really cute. And he looked at me and he said, "Paul, everybody has to find their own Dharma. You can't fit yourself into somebody else's model." A little relief. Maybe I can save you some time by saying that particular story played in the mind. By the way, that pithy, you know, pointing that he gave wasn't the end of the story. You know, it came somewhere probably in the middle. The story went on for a good 10 years. All stories come and go. All movies have their end. Everybody walks out of the theater. Everybody walks out of the theater. And in one way or another, says, "I was at the movies." Nobody says, "That was real." They might say, "That was real like." So this personality view, we're not talking about getting rid of your style. We're talking about freeing your style. We're talking about just what is it that sees the stylization? Because the more the stylization is seen, instead of believed to be what you are, singularly, that frees the stylization up. And then you get to have your way of seeing it. You get to have your way of hearing it. You get to have your way. Second one is the doubt in the teachings. How does this work? It's basically fear. The fear that generates the sense that awakening is meant for some, and I'm not one of them. I've had a bad start. My parents were not so good. My body's not right. I'm too old. I'm just not ready for this. That's the way I was on the first retreat. I was like, "Whoa, this is serious. I think I'll just do a couple of stretches for the old shoulder girdle, just a little couple of stretches and open up that way," I'm thinking to myself. "Just, can I just go like this a little bit and just feel a little relief that way? Not this, like, whoa." And the third, belief that performing rites and rituals, as interesting and maybe fun as they are, can bring deliverance. That labyrinth is a cool thing. If you've never walked on that labyrinth, it's a cool thing for some of us. But the rites and rituals and the way that humans get attached to their rites and rituals, you know how popular that is? And then the blind faith that believes that's really going to make a difference? The worst example of the rite and ritual in my life was when I was meditating with this Bhante Gunaratana, a beautiful monk, Sri Lanka. And he has a forest monastery in Highview, West Virginia. It's in like a fjord. You drive down the road, it's in the country, and the fjord is the mountains, right? And the road is down in between. You go to the end of the road, and there's the monastery. And I'm all into my meditation, and I'm going to meditate, you know, by myself in the kuti. And in those days, things were very rustic. It's improved quite a bit since I was there. And once a week, the Sri Lankans from Washington, D.C. would pour in. In large numbers, with a ton of food. A ton of food. Layers and layers and layers. And I'm there doing my meditation, right? I went in a quiet, in my kuti. But I got to go down into this sea of Sri Lankans, full of intense devotion for their priest. He's their priest. Yeah? Bhante. And I come down for my meal, and they see me. Ah. I swear, some of them probably said, here comes a good-looking guinea pig. We're going to feed him. So here's Bhante sitting up on the stage with a couple other monks, and they're getting fed, and they're just laughing, and they're smiling. And I'm sitting down on the floor, and all of a sudden, Sri Lankans are coming from every direction. Brown people. All over me with a ton of food and these deviled eggs, deviled eggs, deviled eggs. And they get close and look me in the eye and say, and I'm like, again, red, once again, non-duality, red. When you're overwhelmed, you're embarrassed, or you're in bliss, the uniform. So I look up, and I'm just complete, I'm basically almost in tears. I'm feeling like I got to run out of here. You know, I can't because it's like people all around me and deviled eggs all in front of me. And I look up, and here's Bhante, and he's laughing his head off at me, sitting down there overwhelmed. You think you understand what meditation is about? Ha, ha, ha. I mean, that was just my thought. Yeah, so, you know, the beliefs and the rites and ritual. I mean, that was a wonderful ritual. It was a wonderful, you know, practice they had there, you know, giving of the food and the wonderful feeling, the community and all that. Well, I'm not saying that's not a wonderful thing. But the idea that that in and of itself is going to bring freedom from desire, freedom from grasping and freedom from clinging. We have to look a little bit more closely there. So these beliefs and these views, the personality view, the doubt in oneself, the doubt in the teachings, fear, belief in performing rites and rituals, like if I do my stretches every day, it's fine to do stretches every day. It's fine to take care of the body. This is a vehicle for awakening. It makes sense to take care of it. Just not overdo it. Oh, I missed my this, I missed my that. Oh, I'm not doing it right.
You skipped the doubt part.
No, I didn't. I did? Doubt in the teachings. I skipped it? I called it fear. Called it fear, the fear that generates the sense that awakening is meant for some and not for me. You skipped it. Watch out, you're getting red. Ah, we're all one, Janet. So these views and opinions, they keep asserting themselves. That's why the seeing into them and potentially seeing through them seems to take some time. Is the conditioned mind can be very tenacious. And once we see these beliefs and these views as unsatisfactory and limiting, and that, here's the key sentence, there's a fundamental incompatibility between trying to live in a way that's maintaining control and living openly and freely. The contradiction between those two becomes crystal clear. Should I say it again? The contradiction between living in a way, subtly or not so subtly, based on trying to maintain control, trying to maintain control, and living openly and freely. They get so frictional right in there, those two, that what happens? This is where we either fall back and we feel hopeless, confused, maybe helpless, maybe depressed, or the mind goes into checkmate and stops. Which means the energy that's gone into seeking, when the mind goes into checkmate and stops, the energy that's gone into seeking, maintaining control, searching, trying, efforting, that energy dissolves or transforms. That seeking energy, that controlling energy transforms. It releases the belief in being the chooser has been at least somewhat seen through. The belief in control being the way to live is somewhat seen through. And literally, it's a transformation or transmutation of energy that takes place there. Waking up is like a flame being blown out. But instead of there being only darkness, as contrasted to light, when the flame is blown out, there is only light. That can be said better. This is from Hafiz. It is called It Felt Love. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. This is about the light of being, the light of awareness, touching the flowers. This is the flower. The flame in the image is conditioning. And this light of awareness that is not the opposite of darkness, is the wisdom that shines as unconditioned or unconditional awareness. It's like the light that sees in the dark and recognizes not only the darkness, but it also recognizes itself as the light. Now, notice the so-called darkness or shades in this room are inseparable from the light. This is the light of awareness that's being pointed at. And when it's no longer fettered by the idea that I am the light, my deep heart feeling is that when Jesus said, "I am the light," there wasn't any personal I in there. Because what he was saying is, "You're the light too." Seeing that awareness permeates everything, just like the light permeates this room, is how the realization that everything equally matters appears. It's literally how the realization that everything equally matters appears. Awareness is not an object, it's not a thing. It is the function of experiencing. Recognized by itself. So time, meaning, purpose, direction, past and future do not exist except as conceptual constructs in the mind. And the fact that nothing exists as it seems to, meaning solid or permanent, makes it all that much more clear that everything is becoming something other than it was the moment before. And this is the meaning of emptiness. Whatever we believe to be real is a projection of our views and opinions. Insight, which is what this is all about, frees the mind from living in and feeling the need to have to maintain beliefs. The need to have to maintain beliefs. And even more important, this is the exploration of how to be free from need. Again, Hafiz. Watch the way he works with love here. This one's called "With That Moon Language." Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, "Love me." Of course, you do not do this out loud. Otherwise, someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this. This great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying, with that sweet moon language, what every other eye in this world is dying to hear? The so-called outer world, which is a perception that there's a world out there, that's a perception. That's a view. The so-called outer world reflects back the sense that it is out there when awareness is taken as the I that is in here. Whereas the world is a reflection of living, vibrant presence. When awareness is recognized as the open, free space of being that cannot be separated from anything that is occurring. And whether you know it or not, may I suggest to you that if you've been enjoying the window out of the dining room onto the river, it is perhaps not because of what you think it is that you've enjoyed that, but rather what I'm pointing at right now. All of the angst arises from trying to hold on, maintain, and secure something that by nature never actually exists, except as a concept. And so ask right now, what is it that is aware? What is it that is aware? Or if you don't like the length of that, you can simply ask, who is aware? Natural presence of being that abides or proceeds. Any doing, any attempt to alter or change anything. Natural being that proceeds any kind of practice or path, any kind of so-called meditation, any kind of attempts to modify experience. This is where we get in touch with the wisdom that reveals that in this natural presence, there is nothing that needs to change, even as everything keeps changing. There's the recognition of that which needs no modification. Nothing need be better, and nothing needs to be believed in. It's a reconfiguration fundamentally of perception. It's like recognizing that gravity doesn't need to be attended to in order to function perfectly fine. And in fact, when we're moving around in these bodies completely unconscious of gravity, not only has it got us covered quite fine, but we often feel much better. When gravity starts to come in there, we start to feel it in the shoulders or the head or the back. We're starting to feel that burden to some extent. And I think I need a massage. All these organs, this nervous system, even the brain itself, this computer, functions that much more effectively and fine when it is not trying to do life. It's a funny thing. Why is it that the digestive system and all these other systems work so fine naturally, have their own homeostasis, they're being themselves, and something up here says it has to run the show? This doesn't say it has to run the show. Sometimes this says it has to run the show, but this one told this to try to run the show. It's a shift, my friends. It's a shift, a fundamental shift in allegiance. It's not about negating form. It's not about negating experience. It's not about saying this doesn't matter. It's not about some kind of deluded renunciation. It's about shifting into that which sees, so that which is seen can reveal its true nature. Sitting here now still, so that nature can do its job, so that the Dharma can do its work. freedom from opens into freedom amidst. Freedom from is the idea of someone trying to get free from something. Freedom amidst is awareness fully immersed in the dance of life. The energy of seeking transforms into a living stream of unfoldment. And when seeking's not there, it's not. And when seeking is, it is. And it begins to become wonderfully homogenized. One more, Hafiz. One of my favorites. This one is called Now is the Time. Now is the time to know that all you do is sacred. Now, why not consider a lasting truce with yourself and God? Now is the time to understand that all your ideas of right and wrong were just a child's training wheels to be laid aside when you can finally live with veracity and love. Hafiz is a divine envoy whom the Beloved has written a holy message upon. My dear, please tell me, why do you still throw sticks at your heart and at God? What is it in that sweet voice inside that incites you to fear? Now is the time for the world to know that every thought and action is sacred. Now is the time for you to deeply compute the impossibility that there is anything but grace. Now is the season that everything you do is sacred. That's why loving freedom is the same as freedom loving. Encore? Watch the angle on this one. Last one. It's called Only One Rule. The sky is a suspended blue ocean. The stars are the fish that swim. The planets are the white whales I sometimes hitch a ride on. The sun and all the light have forever fused themselves into my heart and upon my skin. There is only one rule on this wild playground. Every sign Hafiz has ever seen reads the same. They all say, have fun. my dear, have fun in the Beloved's divine game. Oh, in the Beloved's wonderful game. Can we sit for a minute?